Right. Okay. So, has anyone got something they want to start with?
I'll start with I've been studying with Tabor, and I have a question about it. It's the Ten Commandments is God's ketubah to Israel. There's good stuff in there, and there's bad stuff in there. Why do you think God threw in thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal in a ketubah?
Okay. Well, in a sense, it's like, I know that's Ian's view that the Ten Commandments is a ketubah. It's how it's written is the issue, and the interpretation of it, thou shalt not, we, because of a view of God which tends to be a judgmental view, that God is a judge, we tend to view things from a wrong perspective. So if you think of the parable of the talents, and you have the 10 talents and the 5 and the 1, and the guy with the 1 talent basically was like, his view of God was, I know you're a hard taskmaster, and you reap when you don't sow, and all this sort of stuff. It's like, and there's an assumption that, okay, well, he must have been right then. Well, no, he wasn't. That isn't what God is like. But it is sometimes people's view of God which changes how they relate in relationship to him. And so if you think of the Ten Commandments as, you shall not commit adultery, or you shall not steal, and you can take it in the negative, but think of it more in, this is what is God's provision for us in relationship with him. So think of it more as, you do not need to steal, because in relationship with me, then you will have all your needs met. Or you do not need to commit adultery, because in your relationship with me, I will provide you with a wife or a husband. Or in your relationship with me, you know, so it's all about God's provision in our relationship, not about we shouldn't do something. And it's taken as these commandments that if you break, you will be punished. And in reality, in our new covenant relationship with God, he is our provider, he is our healer, he is everything. And so if we seek first his kingdom, then everything we need will be added. And so I believe really a lot of people have taken the meaning of those Ten Commandments and have twisted it towards punishment for not doing or doing, rather than, okay, you shall have no other gods before me. Well, why would I want any other god before God? A, he is the only God, and everything else are not gods in reality. But B, in my relationship with him, he is my father, he's my provider, he's my righteousness, he's my peace, he's my sanctification, he's everything I need. So why would I need to go anywhere else? You know, and so some of those things are very much, I believe, misunderstood. And therefore, there isn't negative stuff in there. It's all about our relationship with God. And in our relationship with God, everything is provided for us. And it's complete. And we can live in rest and peace. And should we look outside of our relationship with God, then the consequences of looking outside of relationship with God are negative. You know, well, if you put something as an idol before God, well, the consequences are God won't be my provider, because I'll be looking for something else. As much as he wants to be my provider, I'm choosing to go somewhere else. It's not that he's saying, right, I'm going to punish you, or I'm not going to give you anything. It's my choice to look elsewhere. And I think our whole religious system has been built up around a misunderstanding of who God is, his nature, his character, and therefore how he does things. And that's one major area where I think people have just totally misunderstood. You know, And even when things like, you know, honor your father and mother, you know, those things are not negative. They are, if you actually outwork an understanding of your heritage and what honor does in terms of the reward that comes from honoring others, then we live in blessing. If we do not understand that and we live in dishonor, then we won't receive a reward. Because Jesus talked about receiving, you know, those who receive a prophet, receive a prophet's reward. And the whole principle is built into an understanding of the kingdom and how the kingdom works. And it works in relationship. And so, you know, I don't believe there is a whole lot of negative stuff in there. I think it's just the way we viewed it, if that makes sense. But when it comes to our ketubah, we're looking at, okay, what are our expectations in our marriage relationship? If God is saying, you know, and I'm not saying that the Ten Commandments are the full record of the ketubah of God in relationship with man, because I don't believe that that's true, because a lot of it's tied to our destiny scroll. And so his expectation of me is a fulfillment of my destiny scroll. But my expectation of him is in relationship, he will give me everything I need to fulfill my destiny scroll. So I can hold him accountable to his promises and his word and the covenant promises that he's made, that being my provider, well, I don't want him to provide for my whims. I want him to provide everything so that I can fulfill my destiny. It's not about me. It's about me in relationship to him and what my spirit has already agreed in eternity, and now I begin to outwork that. So, you know, there's a whole different way of looking at things. So when I produced my ketubah, you know, I had, I think, 69 different things on my ketubah. And in producing it, it was all about my expectations of God in relationship for enabling me to outwork the things that he'd already shown me. You know, I didn't put a whole load of things there that I just wanted. It came out of the visions and the revelation and my encounters with him, the prophetic words that have been spoken over my life, different things. That's what I put on my ketubah. And it was like, you know, my ketubah has things like, you know, being a son of God and fulfilling the fullness of the Son of God. Well, you know, it's all those sorts of things. And I had sort of 20 things which are sort of my, what I would call my dreams, of things that I've seen in visions and seen myself doing, but they're all about bringing glory to him, not bringing glory to me. So my whole ketubah is based around fulfilling my destiny. And, you know, and then I can, in agreement with God, we can work together. I mean, that's the whole thing. Again, we can have a ketubah and we can take it out of context, and we can almost like, well, I'm going to twist God's arm by using this marriage contract to make him do what I want him to do. It just doesn't work like that. It's just relationship. You know, why would he agree to something on my ketubah that actually isn't in alignment with his will and purpose for my life? Because he would just be agreeing to something which was negative to me. So, in a sense, you know, I have to be very careful when I'm producing something like that, that it does not flow out of my soul's needs. And they could be unmet needs and unfulfilled desires and expectations of my soul that will cause me to desire certain things which aren't actually in alignment with God's will for me at all. So it's an important process to establish. But in establishing it, then in relationship, we have an agreement that we can hold each other to. But it's all tied around my destiny, really, and that's really, and it's all relational. You know, that's the key. It's not just a functional document, which is an illegal agreement that I have no relationship in. You know, if we're talking about marriage, we have marriage. You know, it's like marriage is a relational thing. It's an intimacy thing. So in my ketubah, if I'm not living in intimacy with God, and I'm not in him, and he's not in me, then there's very little chance that that's going to ever get worked out. But if I'm developing the relationship in me, and then I'm developing my relationship in him and in the realms of heaven, then there's a very good opportunity for things to be worked out. So it flows out of relationship. So, yeah.
In that, when I did my ketubah, I felt like the Lord wanted me to do it, to take a scripture that had been important to me all my life. And Romans 8 has always been something that the Lord has just constantly put before me. And so I used that chapter and formed it out of that.
Sure.
And I felt like that's what and if you read that, it is a lot about destiny too, but it's more about who God is in relation to you.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's what I felt like he was asking me to do in it.
Sure.
So I guess it can look different for individuals.
Yeah, I mean, it should look different because we're all unique and our destinies are different. And those things that are in us that lead us to chapters like that and to passages of scripture or to things like that will be different for all of us. You know, I mean, our in a sense, ketubah here as a church will be based around Isaiah 61. You know, and so that's our DNA, if you like, and everything that we have within our blueprint is an outworking of Isaiah 61. So, you know, I think each individual have a different engagement with something which will enable them to really see, you know, what the relationship is and how the functions of that outwork. And so I would expect everyone's to have different emphases and different ways of doing it. But when it comes down to it, it has to be about relationship. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about establishing the grounds for relationship. So there was a clarity about what expectations there are. Well, God has an expectation that I'm dead to everything other than him. You know, that's an expectation. You know, I have an expectation that he is life to me and the source of everything I need. You know, so from that perspective, you know, if I'm not denying myself taking up the cross to follow him, he has an issue that he can say, well, actually, you're not really doing what our relationship's about, following me. And if in following him he does not provide and actually meet my needs in being able to follow him, then I can say, well, actually you're not doing what you promised. You know, and I use Matthew 6:33 in that process. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness. If I'm doing that, which must be fulfilling my destiny because that is his will and purpose for my life and how I do it, then I have things there which say, you know, those things which I need to eat and clothe and a place to live, then he does that. And, you know, in reality, I'm so busy doing a whole load of things that I haven't got necessarily the time that a whole lot of other people might have to do some of those things for themselves. And so I have to trust him to do some things that I could do for myself if I had the time. I've committed to spending the time seeking first his kingdom, and therefore some things which other people would not even think about asking God for, I have a relationship where I have an expectation that I do not need to worry or concern myself about certain things. And that might be my family, it could be my home or different things. Actually, I'm not going to concern myself about those things because he's going to look after those, because I'm looking after his stuff and he's going to look after mine, because that's what covenant does. Covenant is when you exchange coats and you exchange blood and what they did, and you walk together through the figure of eight, through the sacrifice, you are literally saying what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine. And that's really what the relationship we have with God is about. You know, everything that belongs to him is mine, everything that belongs to me is his. You know, so when it comes to my relationship with him, I don't own anything. In reality, it all belongs to him. You know, so when it comes to sort of finances and things like that, my attitude to it is not, well, what do you want me to give? It's what do you want me to keep? Because actually it's all yours. You know, so what can I use? You know, therefore, and that's not something which is an easy way of looking at it for people, because we're so used to ownership and possessions, and we'll, you know, and some of those things can define us if we allow them to. And so it's being not materialistic in those things. You know, I'm not bothered really about a lot of things because I just pursue God. And, you know, and but there are some times when I like, there are some things that I like, being a boy and like techie things, I like some stuff, and it's like, okay. And he's like, great, no problem. You know, because he knows where my heart is. You know? So, yeah, I mean, that's really how I would sort of see these things out working. It has to be relational, therefore it must be different for all of us. But the same principles apply to it in what it means in terms of relationship and understanding of our covenant that we're in with him. So, yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm going to change the subject a minute.
Okay.
I feel like the Lord is wanting me to write a curriculum on identity.
Yeah.
And he gave me some bullet points the other day. But I realized someone got up the other day in a meeting and was reading a scripture, and it was about the courts. And it occurred to me that in the courts, most every place that I've seen it talk about the courts, it's all about identity. Would you agree with that? When you go into the court, it's changing your identity.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one aspect of it, yeah. I mean, in a sense, if you're looking at the mobile court, or let's say the accusationary court, where the enemy brings accusations against us, he is going to use those type of things against us. So, yeah, it's about how I think about myself, you know, lies I might believe. You know, if I want my identity to be aligned with who God says I am and what he says and what he sees when he looks at me, then my mind needs to be renewed so I am not conformed to the identity that the world has given me, but I'm conformed to the identity that he has given me and what was mine in eternity. So all the vast sum of the thoughts about him. So a lot of the court cases can be around that, but I don't think it's entirely that, although it has to be the basis of we're there, because we're there as the righteousness of God and as sons of God. So if we don't know that, then we have no authority. And in any of the courts, without knowing your identity, you have no authority. If I don't know that I can operate in lordship, then I can't operate in lordship. So my identity in that as a son of God is outworked in its position of lordship while I'm maturing as a son. And so, yeah, I think the basis of it is definitely identity in all the courts. You know, I can't operate in the court of kings if I don't know my authority in kingship. You know, I can't operate on my mountain if I don't know I'm called to be responsible for these governmental spheres as a king or lord or son. So in a sense, the essence of it is all coming out of knowing my position of identity and authority. And that really is, you know, I am the mountain, basically. It's like it is who I am as a son of God and as a symbol of authority in the kingdom. Now, there are lots of things you do in the courts which are not directly to do with identity. You know, you can go and administer in the courts for healing. You can go and administer things which are maybe for a physical thing. But it's all going to be tied back to the authority that I have to administer that is on the basis of what God says about me. You know, and if it doesn't line up with what God says about me, then I can operate judicial protocols to deal with it. You know, so yeah, definitely the foundation of it is me knowing who I am. Although a lot of the things you do there won't necessarily always be just dealing with identity. It comes out of identity. So yeah. If I'm a lord, then I can operate in lordship, and that means I can bring the rule of God through my life as a gateway onto the earth, or administer a realm of the kingdom in that way. But so it's definitely founded that on that.
Yeah. Do you think that when David, in several psalms, when he's talking about the courts and in the courts and with Thanksgiving and, you know, do you think he was actually having experiences of going into the courts and administering and doing stuff like that?
I think David was able to access time beyond his time. So some of the things he expressed in his Psalms very much were coming out of the New Covenant. Things like, take not your Holy Spirit from me and things like that. Well, people didn't have the Holy Spirit in them in the same way as they do now. You know, so he, his expression of things indicated that he had a personal revelationary understanding of his of intimacy with God. You know, he was a man after God's own heart, it says in Acts 13, I think. And he fulfilled the purpose of God in his generation. So there was something about David having the keys, you know, the keys of David, the whole thing about the tabernacle of David. There was this thing in worship that he saw into the future. You know, he was able to have open worship around the ark of the presence of God. Well, you know, that didn't take place until Jesus opened the veil. And for most people, that hadn't even taken place in reality until recently, until they realized they can go into the heavenly Holy of Holies and engage the ark. Right? So he was way ahead of his time in those experiences. I think probably because of his understanding of worship and understanding of sound and frequency and vibration and maybe what that opened for him to engage in that. You know, I definitely think he walked in the outside of his normal time in understanding and revelation. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. Is you know, a good person to go and talk to and ask him and find out in the sense. Okay, well, you know, how did you know how to do that? You know, and when you wrote that, what were you meaning? You know, it's that type of interaction that we can have, I guess, with him. But definitely, he's a very significant figure when you look at understanding what the keys of David are and the tabernacle of David. It's very much about our day, you know. And I think understanding some of the musical and frequency-based things were, you know, interesting, you know. That really, really common song, Leonard Cohen's song about, Hallelujah. You know, it's like, you know, the key, the chord, David's secret chord type of thing. You know, there was something that, you know, seems to be, you know, about sound and what he was able to do. You know, and certainly when it came to, you know, them engaging around the ark, you know, there was 24/7 praise and engagement and scribes writing down prophetic things, and it was just amazing. You know, well, that wasn't normal. You know, it wasn't like, and after David, when Solomon built the temple, it was not like that again either. You know, until Jesus came and tore the veil of the curtain of the temple and opened it all up through what he did on the cross. So
when he talked about being a man after God's own heart,
yeah. Looks like you're frozen there. It looks like she's lost her connection or something. But, yeah, I mean, David was a man after God's own heart. Now, if you look at it again from many people in their form of how they treat other Christians and people's behavior and sort of the judgment side of things, it's like they wouldn't. Why would we be reading Psalms of a murderer and an adulterer? But from God's perspective, from that New Covenant perspective, his view is, he's a man after my own heart. Why? Because he was repentant. Yeah? And in that repentance, he did not receive God's judgment. Now, there were some consequences to his behavior, which was outworked, you know, in future generations. But, you know, he was seen as a man after God's own heart. And I think that's a key in understanding how God treats us and deals with us with grace and with mercy when we're repentant and when our hearts are right. Looks like she's back.
Yeah, my power went out for a second.
You can't do without power in the kingdom.
I know. What I was asking was, when it talks about him being a man after God's own heart, you know, do you feel like that was the way God referred to him, because he could step into that sonship role?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, I think everything about David's life is a way in which we can see how God treats us. I was just saying while you were off air, you know, people's view of God can be encapsulated in how they view David and how God treated David and how God could say, you know, in the New Testament, well, here's a man after my own heart, because God forgave David because David was repentant and contrite of heart, you know. And so people were treated that way. So, you know, that's really why God was able to say that, and that because David did have intimacy with God. You know, there was an intimacy that David had with God that revealed and unveiled God's heart and some of the eternal things of God's heart that David was attuned to. And so that's why he was able to have that place. But, you know, most people, if you were to say to people, oh, there's an adulterer and a murderer in the church, they would be saying, right, get rid of them, put them out. You know, we can't have those people around. It's like, but they don't have a problem. Well, maybe some of them do, but actually reading the Psalms of David and worshipping to the Psalms of David, and yet we treat each other very differently often than how God treats us. And God treated David with forgiveness and love and mercy and grace. And, you know, we need to treat each other with the same respect and realize that God, that is what God is like. He is a loving, merciful God. You know, he doesn't want to punish us. Jesus has taken all the punishment so we can embrace his love. You know, and David definitely knew the love of God. And he knew intimacy with God. And he must have spent a long time just worshipping, out with the sheep, just spending time in intimacy, developing that heart. Now, you know, it didn't mean that he didn't make mistakes. He obviously did. We can see and read about his mistakes. But even that is a sign that what God can do with us when our hearts are right with him and when we're willing to be contrite of heart to make sure we stay that way with him. He'll use us and bless us and be in relationship with us. So, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I have a question from Donald, so I'm gonna answer this question from Donald.
Hey, Mike, go back to the...
Yeah, okay. Go on then, yeah.
Go back to the... How often do you... Or go back to you take
a okay, I'm finding it quite difficult to hear what you're saying. You're breaking up a little bit. How often do I go back to my ketubah? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, it's basically my frame of reference for how I live, in that it's centered around my destiny scroll. So I don't want to do anything that's not on my destiny scroll, so every day I will align myself around the Ark of the Presence of God, looking for his will and purpose, looking to come into a resonant agreement with that which is my destiny for today, and receive a mandate to do it. So that gives the foundation for all that. So in a sense, it's not that I go back and read it and look at it in those terms. I carry it in my heart, because actually it's the foundation for everything that gets worked out, because it is God's desire and will and purpose for me that I've agreed to, and it's my relationship with him that I then trade on, effectively. You know, the word of God, the promises of God, those things are things I can trade on because they count, and they are my covenant of exchange. I exchange on behalf of those things, you know. So I can't say I go back and read it specifically, but I carry it, you know, and everything comes out of that. So every day I'm really much looking to outwork it, you know. And so everything must be based on it for me in that sense. So when I step into him and I engage with him in intimacy, I'm very much just engaging in the relationship that's based on this agreement that we have with each other. You know, but it's a love agreement. It's not a legal framework document that is just dealt with in a harsh judicial way. It's a love relationship. Why would I not want to fulfill his purpose? Because I love him. Why would he not want to bless me? Because he loves me. It's just, that's how it works. I mean, I did have to deal with it from the point of not getting my identity from what I do, but from who I am. And therefore, you know, when I was on a fast and going through quite a difficult time, when I'd been through 4 months of darkness and was going through this sort of period of going through the dark cloud to engage God's person and things, I got to a point where each of those things on my list, when there were 69 of them, each of them I died to. It was like, if I never ever did one of those things again, how would I feel about myself? If God never did any of the things he promised, how would I feel about him? And I had to get to the point where if I never did anything ever again for God, I know he would still love me, and therefore I can still know my identity in him. And if he never did another thing for me, or I never got to outwork any of my dreams or visions, I know that I would still love him and trust him. Now, that was a really hard process for me. You know, it really was, because I found that my spirit trusts him and my soul didn't. You know, I thought I trusted God, and it was like, yeah, of course I trust him. But when it came to, well, not knowing what he's doing and not knowing and being in the dark, and, you know, it was just like it caused my soul to react and kick off, and it showed me the areas I needed to die. And those were things about my identity. You know, my identity is irrelevant in my relationship with God towards whether I do anything or not. It's about who I am in that relationship as a son. I'm still a son regardless of whether I do anything. Now, I want to do stuff because I'm a son, not to try and prove I'm a son or be a son because I'm doing things that a son does. And it's very, very, you have to see it from the right perspective. And literally every one of my 69 things died, and I grieved, and I let them go, and I knew that they weren't the issue. It was relationship which was the issue. And that freed me completely to trust God, to know that he trusts me, to love him, to know that I'm loved by him, and know that anything I do does not impact on that relationship. You know, whether I do the things that he wants me to do or whether I don't, actually does not impact his love for me. He still loves me, irrespective. Now, of course, in doing those things and outworking my destiny, it has an effect on the future and various things, but not on my relationship of intimacy. You know, and eventually I burnt my ketubah and sent it up as an offering and laid it on the altar of incense and offered it as an offering before God, so that it's not really the issue anymore. Everything's about relationship, you know. And why wouldn't I want to love God and serve him and do those things? Because I love him, you know, and I know that he wants to bless me because he loves me. Now, sometimes that means he needs to discipline me and train me and equip me, not punish me, but sometimes he corrects me, and sometimes I don't take it as, oh no, God doesn't love me. You know, I'm not operating out of fear or out of those things anymore, because I've been freed from that. Because I know God. You know, I've seen him face to face. I mean, I know him. I know how much he loves me and cares about me. I know those things are true. So I'm not caught up in the fear of man or legalistically wanting to earn anything from God, because I know what he's like. You know, I've encountered him in such a way and such ways that I really do know him. Now, okay, I might just know a fraction when it comes to the omniscience of God and everything like that. I'm not saying I know everything he knows, but what I'm saying is I know him. I've spent so much time in intimacy with him that I know him. I feel like I know him, you know, in relationship, you know. And that's really the importance of it all for me in this. It's relationship. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I will read Donald's question. Otherwise, I'll... So Donald asked about the first and second creation and about, does Genesis 1 describe the first creation and Genesis 2, 4b describe the second one? And where did Adam's garden go after the fall? And, you know, where are the two trees now located after the fall? So it's like there's a few questions there. In answering it, I think the key for me is I don't see Genesis 1 as the first creation and Genesis 2, 4 as the second. I don't see it that way. I see it as Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth as the first creation. Then I see the earth was form and without void because of Satan's fall as a recreation. So then he recreated the earth and the heavens as originally he created the heavens and the earth, because everything was spiritual before it became physical. Now, to understand the nature of the garden and to understand the nature of where we were at that point, we need to understand that the earth was actually in the dimension of the spirit. So the garden that God walked in, we would call Eden, was a heavenly dimensional garden. And the garden in east of Eden was also a heavenly dimension garden connected to the earth, which was in that sphere. When Adam fell, the whole of the created physical order was taken out of that eternal sphere and placed into time and space. And it was when it was in time and space so that sin and everything associated with sin could be contained. So in eternity there will be no reference or record of sin because it will be contained within time. And therefore the garden that Adam walked in and the garden that we would say was in that garden with Eden, they were both in the spiritual sphere. And when the fall happened, the pathway, which is really what the trees are talking about, the pathway that engages the source of life, was actually guarded by the cherubim and the fiery sword to stop people walking into that in a fallen state. So the pathway where the second tree is, if you like, is a pathway of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. It's the choice that everyone has to make, and it's available in this realm. It does not exist as a tree, if you like, in the realm of the spirit, because it never really was a tree in that sense. It was a pathway, a choice of engagement. And when you look at the tree of life, it really is talking about the street that runs through it and the river that runs. It's all about the pathway and the source of life. And so we can re-engage it now because we have access into that realm, into the garden of God, where we can re-engage it. Now then, in a sense, the garden that was Adam's to tend and cultivate now is actually the garden of our heart, which is a spiritual realm. It's just within our heart, not in this natural realm, in your sense. It's in the spiritual realm, in our heart. And so that's really where these things sort of work out and overlap. And the recreation was bringing restoration when the Spirit hovered over the waters. God did not make the original creation to be uninhabited. It says in Isaiah that he made it to be for a habitation. So it was as a result of what happened with Satan's fall and the result of what Satan did on the planet with the dinosaurs and all the other stuff he was trying to do to stop man inheriting, because That's the problem. Satan looked into the firestones and saw man's future, which was to rule the heavens and the earth. And as a result of that, rebelled, and then tried to mess up that future for mankind because he wanted to occupy that place for himself. You know, so, you know, now the garden is in our own heart. And the river that flows out of Eden now flows through our first love gate into our spirit and into the garden of our own heart, which is the river of life and the source of life. So we are now an outworking of that, because it originally the river flowed from Eden to Adam and Eve's garden and then flowed out of their garden to water the rest of the earth. And of course they were supposed to subdue and have dominion and bring the whole earth to be the garden. That was their intention, so that the whole earth would become patterned after Eden. And they had access to Eden to be able to do that, you know, but their choice is still available as the pathway of that knowledge of good and evil today that we get to make every day. We get to choose whether we take up our cross and follow him by denying that choice and free will, or choosing to exercise that free will and do our own thing. So that tree is, if you like, or the pathway is there available for every single person on the planet every day of their lives. And it's what we do with that choice which is the key. So I don't want free will. You know, every time I exercise free will apart from God, it's not a good result. So, you know, I surrender my free will every day by denying that. I don't want it. All I want is the choice to follow him. And so I surrender that in a denying myself every day, not choosing to accept that pathway. Because there are a whole load of good things on that pathway which are not the best things. Because it was the knowledge of good and evil. It didn't mean everything was bad. It just meant using that as our supply to provide our identity out of work and out of the things becomes essentially a snare, but it's also, if you think, dead works. They're all dead. Even the good works that will bring us righteousness are dead works, because they cannot bring us righteousness apart from God. You know, so that's what the pathway does. It offers us a whole series of dead works to try and earn the favor of God, and none of that can work. You know, and we can do nothing apart from God that's got any profit. You know, and I think Jesus said in John, you know, the flesh profits nothing. So if our choices are to follow that path, then there can be no profit for us in our life. And there may be some natural rewards, because Jesus said, well, you get some rewards if you do your things before men. But if you want to do things that have an eternal reward that are in the realms of the Spirit, then you do things before God. And your motivation must be to please and serve God, not to please and serve man or ourselves, as being one of those people, if you like. So, yeah, interesting question.
I got a follow-up to that.
Yep.
So I've heard Ian talk about that in the garden Eve did not actually eat the apple, it was something else. But I never really heard that teaching.
Yeah.
So do you think the tree of knowledge of good and evil is figurative as well? Not an actual tree, but a path?
Oh, yeah, it definitely. Yeah, it's a path.
So what did Eve do? Do you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you explain that?
Yeah, Eve gave her DNA to Satan. Yeah, that's what Eve did. It was the seed. You see, the tree is always about the seed, you know, because that was the purpose of a tree is effectively to produce fruit that has seeds in it that can reproduce after its kind. And so Adam and Eve chose to reproduce after their kind apart from God. If they had chosen to follow the pathway of the tree of life, they could have reproduced after their kind in God's way. Now, you know, there's a whole lot of things around this. A, Adam and Eve had children before the fall, so because they were given a commission to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth. So that they had children before the fall. Those children are now some of the ancient ones who ascended like Enoch. So there's a whole group of stuff that happened before that. What Satan offered them was a way of knowledge, and he traded information with them for their seed. And therefore, Eve gave herself to produce a seed with her DNA. And, you know, there are different opinions to what happened. Some say it was a sexual thing. You know, I know Ian's view is that there was an overshadowing, in which, just as Mary was overshadowed, that was able to produce seed, then Eve was overshadowed and it was able to produce seed. Later on with the Nephilim, they also took women and they genetically used them to produce seed. You know, so you have Nephilim seed, you have serpent seed. So when it came to Genesis 3:15, God says, you know, about the first prophecy about the coming Messiah, he talks about the seed of woman. He didn't talk about the seed of man. Interestingly enough, he talked about the seed of woman. And Eve is the mother of all living. Didn't say Adam was the father of... So there's an interesting thing there, which is an indication of where some of these things are coming from. And essentially, Satan was after the DNA because he wanted a seed. And therefore, Jesus was described as the seed of the woman. And it also talks about the seed of the serpent. And so Cain was the seed of the serpent. Abel was the seed of the woman. And eventually, because Cain killed Abel to stop the seed producing the Messiah, so then Seth then became the seed of the woman to replace Abel. And that was the line that eventually produced Jesus. And you know, it talks about, you know, him crushing his heel, you know, biting his heel, and then him crushing the head. You know, that was the whole prophetic thing. But Jesus talked about the sons of the kingdom, and he talked about the sons of the evil one. And he talked about in the parable of the seed that the enemy had planted seed within the realm of the kingdom. And he has, you know, he placed it, planted his own seed. You know, so you know that's really what it was really talking about. So the whole pathway there was the choice that God gave them to follow him, and they chose the choice that the enemy gave them to follow that way of producing fruit ultimately. And now, you know, we have a mixture of seed, which is why we need to be purified and genetically transformed into the image of Jesus, not to be conformed to the image that has come from our genetic history and generational history, but to be conformed to the image of Christ. And to do that, we need to be transformed, and to be transformed we need our mind renewing so that we can actually see things from God's perspective, to see what his identity for us was. It's not, you know, the renewing of our mind is not like, oh, well, I'm going to get 20 scriptures and I'm going to confess them every day to change how I think. It's actually looking from the perspective of God, seeing his thoughts about us, seeing our destiny scroll, seeing everything about who we are as his sons, and then living out of the revelation that that produces and the change it produces in us to be conformed to that image. You know, that's the image. You know, I know, you know, the whole teaching about renewing your mind and using the Word of God to remind. Yeah, there are some scriptures that can help us with that. But we have to step into him, and we need to look back into what was in his heart so that we can bring that into what is today, so that we can transform what will be tomorrow. And that's all about intimacy and relationship, which will bring that revelation and release that so that we can be who he created us to be. And that will take soul and spirit transformation. You know, I mean, our spirit has been reborn, so it is already that way. And so the transformation there is not a change per se, but a being made alive and then being brought back into authority within us. But then our soul needs to be transformed and our body needs to be transformed. So we need the resurrection power of the cross to affect not just our soul, but our body, so that we can have a resurrection body in this realm, not just after we die, so that we can operate as transfigured sons of God, radiating the light of God and emanating the frequency of God around us as we begin to manifest the kingdom around and through our lives. You know, but it's a fairly, you know, it's a process we have to go through. You know, so every day we get this choice. You know, Ian talks about, well, the kingdom is here, and if you look into it, then you engage it. But there's another choice to look into every day. Do we choose this or this? And, you know, it is something we really need to do every day, not just to assume, well, God knows what my choice is. Actually, no, we need to choose. You know, it's a daily thing to deny yourself and take up the cross and follow him. Because we have free will. And that free will gives us the permission to choose to say no, as well as to choose to say yes. I just don't want to do that, so I surrender that immediately. You know, I give him the government of my life. You know, I enthrone him in my spirit as on the seat of rest and government, because that's when I can live out of peace and out of rest, and where I don't need to strive for my identity in what I do. I'm at peace and rest in him, because he's on the throne. And of course he's wanting me to be on that throne so that I can begin to rule with him, you know. Just like Jesus was on the right hand of the Father, he wants me to be on his right hand. And I do that in my own spirit, on the throne that's in my spirit. I enthrone him, if you like, in that place, and then I take my place alongside of him. And therefore he fathers me and teaches me how to be a good son, which is to how to rule, you know, how to release my creativity, you know, how to do what Jesus did, you know, and not just the works that he did, but the greater works that he did and the heavenly works that he did also. I get to understand some of what that is and begin to outwork it.
Nobody else has a question. I have one more.
Okay.
I heard a teaching from Ian recently. It was on a podcast, and it was about, I can't even tell you what it was about because it just kind of blew my mind. But
yeah,
it's about how Adam made the animals and Eve by breathing.
Yeah, breathing.
And into forming.
Yeah. Breath of God, yeah.
Okay. And how Ian sees in the 2050 season that that's going to be our reality. As we're going to desire things, breathe it out, it's going to create.
Yeah.
Well, in that teaching, he talks about the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
He talks about there not being a spoken language before that.
Yeah.
I don't understand where he gets that. It doesn't compete with my brain.
Cool. Yeah. Someone else has asked me this. I think I did cover it in another session to a degree. Some of the things that Ian says are by revelation, and some of them are his opinions. You know, and it's not, you know, and some of it is, I don't agree with everything he says. I'm not saying he's wrong. I just haven't had that experience myself that I can actually say, yeah, that's my personal experience. Because I'm not going to say yes or no to some things unless it's my personal experience. So I can say, yeah, I know that's true because I've experienced that. So I hold a whole load of things that Ian says in tension that I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying I have got no personal experience of that. Do I understand the whole issue of, God breathing into us and then we breathing out? That's, yeah, absolutely, because that is what we do in terms of God spoke. And he spoke the thoughts that were created as the desires of his heart, and then he released that as a wavelength of light and sound to bring creative things into order. And so absolutely, yes, we can do that. And we will learn how to do that much more effectively and efficiently in the future. When it comes to Babel, it's, again, understanding what happened at Babel and what they were looking to do and why that was such a bad thing. Again, they were looking to form a city to give themselves an identity or a name apart from God. So, A, that was a bad choice to start with. B, they were looking to re-engage that which Adam had before the fall when he could engage in the realms of the spirit. And so they were looking to do it. Now, some Jewish rabbis have teaching that says that they discovered some technology that enabled them to open up the realm of heaven. There are some accounts of where that has been subsequently done by some other people that have let some negative things through from another realm, some of them to do with Scientology and some of them to do with some occult practices, Edgar Cayce and some of the other things. So there's some history around some of these things. Now, what was lost at Babel was the ability to operate the bandwidth of sound by thought to move things and change things by thought power. So does that mean that they didn't have a spoken language? The written language that Moses used to write down the history of the first five books, he wrote that history. Well, he wrote that because he looked into, remember that the goodness of God passed by and he saw his backside. Well, he wasn't really looking at his back, he was looking back into, he saw the future past. So he was able then to use the language to write it down. Now, Hebrew is obviously a pictorial language, so there are stories associated with the words, and each word becomes a series, the letters of the word or a picture, and you get a comic strip of various things outwork from the letters. After that bandwidth was lost, then everything was then they were unable to communicate. Now, I know Ian teaches that the base languages were encoded within their DNA. I mean, again, it's just something I don't know. I don't have a personal experience with that. I've never really felt it matters one way or another to me. Some of these things, do they matter? If they had a spoken language or didn't have a spoken language, they were able to communicate, which is what it's about. And they were one in their communication, so they knew. And that knowledge was, and the unity of that knowledge, which in one they wanted to engage back into heaven, obviously was forbidden. And whatever happened in terms of removing that bandwidth and that ability that they had, particularly in the form of sound, was changed. And so certainly they had to use spoken language, because they weren't able to use what they were able to do before. There are some things that, I can understand why it could cause some issues of confusion, because it's like God said and God saw, let there be light. So, God spoke. Now, we need to understand what he was doing in speaking. He was releasing a vibrational sound and a frequency, which was his will, and that frequency formed matter in connection with the light, because God is light. So we tend to think of, well, God said, must be what we now hear as when people speak, but it doesn't necessarily follow the case, because we're talking about God, he's a spirit. Did a whole load of airwaves come out of the spirit realm, which contained his voice. Well, no, obviously not, you know, because sounds are just vibrational frequencies in the air, really, of pressure waves, which our ear picks up the pressure waves and vibrates down the eardrum and across the stirrup and anvil and the little bones, and eventually gets translated as something forms in my brain that tells me that is this word or this sound. You know, but actually it isn't really that. That's just the interpretation my brain has learned how to do. It's actually a series of vibrational frequencies. So when God said, he created the vibrational frequency that holds the whole universe together. And that is the strings that are vibrating at the subatomic particles that holds everything together, his grace. You know, it wasn't actual words, you know, in the sense of how we know them. But then what are words? They're exactly the same thing. I say something and waves of pressure come out of my mouth and things pick it up as waves. You know, that's how it is. You know, so understanding vibration and frequency and how that works is a clue to how it worked then. You know, and then something changed because they were confused where they weren't before. You know, but that obviously set the pattern of nations, because those that had the same language migrated together and they spread out. You know.
Do you think that as we get more revelation of the frequency, that we will be able to step into that place as it was back then?
We, without a doubt, our call and purpose is to terraform and bring creation back into its original condition. And in doing that, we will have to be able to release the creative abilities of sound and light that are encoded within our DNA, because they're sequenced and encoded within our DNA, and we can reactivate them by speaking and taking communion and taking on the DNA of God and getting back all the things that were lost. So Jesus, in his life, is a good pattern to see some of the things that we can get back. So the control of weather, the control of the vibrational frequency of objects and matter so that they change form, hence his ability to walk on the water. He was able to change the vibrational frequency of the molecules of the water so that they became solid to his feet. He was able to multiply food. He was able to turn water into wine. So change the vibrational frequency of one thing into something else. He was able to control the vibrational frequency of his physical body so that he could pass through people and could disappear. So he was able to do a whole load of things. And we're going to be able to do those things at the bare minimum and greater things than those. So, yeah. The creative ability that's encoded within us will release things. Now, ultimately, that will release galaxies and release a whole lot of things, because we're not just talking about this planet. If Adam and Eve had not failed and they had ascended into the image of God, which is what they should have done, then they would have filled the earth with the garden, and then they would have then gone out to fill other spheres, dimensions, planets, whatever you like, with the garden. You know, now, if that was God's original purpose, then it will still be his purpose. You know, so there's a whole thing. I know, you know, Dr. O talks about the ability to go and repopulate planets and different things in the future. You know, now, I'm not saying one way or another whether that is something we will do in this age or in the age to come. You know, I know Jesus is going to come back for a spotless church without blemish and wrinkle. Therefore, there's a fair bit of transformation that needs to take place before that's going to take place. Also, he's not coming back, according to Acts 3:19-21, until the restoration of all things takes place. are those things spoken by the ancient ones? Now, we assume that that must be just the prophetic things that are written in the Bible. It doesn't mean that. There was a whole load of things that were spoken. What is the most ancient things that were spoken? Well, it must have been the things that God spoke. You know, so there will be a restoration into God's original purpose. You know, and that is something we can look forward to being involved in. You know, but for that to be fully functioning, God has to trust us with that ability. And just imagine what it would be like if every Christian was entrusted with the ability that everything they said would take place. There would be chaos. Because Christians are so full of so many idle words that people would be dead and damned because they cut them up at an intersection or whatever in their car. Because when there's the level of maturity needed as sons to operate in that level of authority is not there with that many people. Because we have to be those that operate from righteousness and justice. So that's why transformation is such an important issue, so that we can be trusted and empowered with those abilities again to be able to release the creative things of God. And yeah, Adam had the raw materials. He then created the shapes and the colors and everything out of the desire of the creative ability in his own heart. Of course, connected to God, not independent on him, but as a son, with the creative abilities that were released to him. And some of those, of course, will be restored. But, you know, yeah, it's an interesting stuff. You know, some of it is, okay, does the details really matter, or do the principles matter? And I know that Ian says some things that cause people just to like, oh, what is he on about? And for me, I've learned to just park some of that and not worry about it, because it doesn't matter. You know, actually, does it really matter? What matters is an understanding of how communication takes place in the realm of the spirit and our part to play in that in God, and it's all about frequency and vibration. And that's what we'll learn how to operate in. And ultimately, we will learn how to operate in creative light as well as created light, and therefore, light being a wave and a particle and all that stuff will also be revealed, and we'll get revelation of that which is unveiled. You know, but yeah, there we are. Anyway, okay. All right, okay. Well,